In this part of the program, we'll be talking about the American Revolution and how it is that it came about. And our guest is T.H. Breen. He's professor of history at Northwestern University and is an authority on the culture and politics of the early Atlantic world. He's written 6 major books, and we'll talk about some of the ideas you will find in his most recent, which is titled The Marketplace of Revolution. When you think about conditions in this country in the years leading up to the American Revolution, and you start looking at what it was that people thought about, what their experiences were, what their backgrounds were, it becomes increasingly unlikely the idea that they could all get together work together towards the common cause of independence for the colonies, because it seems that sometimes that they spent as much time arguing with each other, grumbling, complaining about people who lived in other parts of the colonies as they did complaining about the British. But there was one thing that all of these people who had these very different backgrounds, ethnic and religious backgrounds, there was one thing that they had in common. They were all consumers. And in fact, Professor Breen says it was this shared experience that gave the colonists the cultural resources that they needed to develop what was a radical strategy of protest, the consumer boycott. You can find this idea carried out in greater detail in his book, The Marketplace of Revolution, the subtitle, How Consumer Politics Shaped American Independence. It's published by the Oxford University Press, is out now. And of course, questions, comments are welcome as we move along here through the hour. If you'd like to join us, that's fine. All we ask of callers is that they're brief. We ask that so that we can get as many people into the conversation and keep things moving. Comments, though, are welcome. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, Professor Breen, hello.
Hello, David. How are you doing?
I'm fine, thanks. And yourself?
It's great. It's I'm looking out on a snowy Evanston morning, which is typical of spring here.
Well, we've actually had a little snow here yesterday. It's I guess that's the Midwest for you. From one day to the next, you don't know what's going to be happening. Well, you know, in the book, in the introduction, you tell a little story about how it is you got thinking about this, and it concerns a visit that you made to Williamsburg, and you talk about the fact that you were walking through an area where they have items on display from colonial times, but they were not things that were produced in the United States. They were items that were produced in Britain and then were exported for the colonists to purchase. And you say that there was one thing that particularly caught your eye, and it happened to be a teapot. Tell us about that.
Right. Well, it's one of my favorite artifacts. As you note, when people go to a center, a fabulous center like Williamsburg, they tend to want to see artisans produce objects as they imagine it was by their forefathers. And Williamsburg found in its collection so many goods that had been made in England, not in America, that they finally had to create a separate gallery, an absolutely fabulous gallery I highly recommend to your listeners, called the Wallace Gallery. And it's entirely a collection of imported goods, imported from England into the colonies during the 18th century. And amongst that collection, I found a fabulous teapot. It's about 4 inches high. It's very small and very delicate. And it said, no Stamp Act. An object made in England, shipped across the ocean, unloaded, taken to a store at Williamsburg, sold to an American to help the American protest British policy. And at that moment, I realized how central the consumer market was to the politics of protest in this period. It just keyed me in to an entirely different way of looking at the past.
Yeah, it's a fascinating notion that this thing would have been made in Britain for export to the United States, and it was a functional item. It was also, in a way, a decorative item, and it was also a political statement.
Right. I might say that once I was keyed into these objects, I found another teapot in the Peabody Museum in Essex, Massachusetts, up near Salem, and that one bears the imprint of Stamp Act repealed, so that what I didn't have, in other words, just a single one-off teapot, and that second teapot indicated how broad spread this consumer market was in colonial America, and the the standardization of buying habits.
Yeah. And that, there's a photograph of that one, too. That both of them are in the book, sort of as bookends, one in the beginning and one near the end. And they're actually, they look rather similar, as a matter of fact.
Very similar. I was very pleased for Williamsburg now reproduces that teapot. And you can purchase it in one of those little stores they have there. I must say it's my fondest object in my office now.
I think when one thinks about the American Revolution, at least what we were all taught in school, we were taught that the thing that the revolution was about, it was about ideas or ideals. It was ideological. That's the thing that brought people together, because they agreed on this set of principles, things having to do with various kinds of freedom and the ability to express it. And that was really what it was about. Here you're making a very different kind of argument, and one that seems that people have received it apparently and said this is very interesting, and also have pointed out that no one has quite made this argument before.
No, my book returns to an older historiography, and the question before me was how did the colonists manage to get together? You alluded to that in your fine introduction at the start of the hour, but when you think of the differences of economics and religion and ethnicity, it's really quite surprising that the colonists were able to mount a common cause against what was the strongest empire in the world in terms of military and financial power. And, of course, the standard answer for a long time is that you just simply mouth certain words, freedom, liberty, rights, property. And these are fine. This is a fine vocabulary, but for people that do not trust each other, a vocabulary of freedom is not enough. If you're living in South Carolina, you own slaves, you're primarily concerned with the rice market, you're maybe deeply suspicious of Puritans in Massachusetts as economic competitors, if not radicals. You have to develop, as I argue in the book, a sense of trust, of commonality, solidarity, before the ideology carries much persuasive purchase, so that the marketplace, the shared sense of marketplace, and then the protest, the boycott movement, allowed colonists in different places to monitor each other's honesty and to develop a sense of trust. If South Carolina didn't stop buying goods, it became very quickly apparent to people in Philadelphia, New York, and Boston because of the newspaper coverage. And out of these attempts to develop an ever stronger boycott movement and the radicalization of ordinary people came a greater sense of the possibilities of creating a new society built precisely on those principles of liberty and freedom. But if you start with the words, if you start with the ideology, you can't make a revolution. You have to create an infrastructure in which these words are credible.
When people think about America in those times, I'm sure that part of their perception is shaped by places like Williamsburg. When you go there and you see people dressed in period costumes and they're doing things like making wagon wheels and horseshoes and things like that, and that we've also been kind of seduced by the idea of the ideal of the yeoman farmer as extolled by Jefferson and other people, and have got this idea that Americans at the time were very self-sufficient. They were producing basically everything that they needed to use in their everyday life. And this is actually not at all the case.
When my book appeared, some of my friends said that the critics would pick up on this element, and that is that I run against the standard mythology that Americans were self-sufficient, divorced from the market. Men and women in little homesteads made all their clothes, and that's what is celebrated, as you say, in some of these museums like Williamsburg or in New England, Sturbridge Village. Mm-hmm. But in and that's why so much of the book I had to counter that with evidence from advertisements, from archaeology, from museums, from letters. Everywhere you turn, men or women were doing pretty much what I can't speak for you, David, but what my family does, and that is buy goods, clothe your family, buy the cloth, buy metal goods, and often doing it precisely the same way that we do it, and that is on credit. The tremendous opening of this marketplace through credit gave leverage to quite ordinary men and women to participate in fulfilling their desires. I mean, like us, they wanted to be pretty, warmer, more sanitary, live better lives, to outdo their neighbors. And this vibrant and explosive marketplace of the mid-century allowed them to do it. And up and down the seaboard, you find the same vibrant collection of goods advertised. Now, of course, when they first began to purchase, they had no idea that this would be a weapon against the empire. And the book talks about the transformation from consumer pleasure to radical protest.
It's interesting, just the you would expect that wealthy people would do this, that they would identify with wealthy people in Europe and on the continent, and they would want the same kind of clothing and tableware and jewelry and all sorts of things like that. But apparently this was something that people, to the extent that their means allowed them, that all people did, in all Americans did.
Right. I mean, one of the elements of economic analysis is that wealthy people may buy better goods, bigger cars or fancier cars or boats or whatever, but there's a limit in consumption. And very soon, knockoff goods or copies or, frankly, companies in England were able to lower the prices so that ordinary people were able to get what was formerly a luxury good. In any case, almost all the people that were free in what became the United States participated fully in this marketplace. And as I show, by the eve of American independence, America was England's best marketplace. I mean, it took off a huge percentage of all goods exported from the mother country. And so it was not unusual for economic theorists of the time in England to talk about consumer colonies. It was a new way of looking at empire, which we find familiar today, but it was new in the 18th century.
We have a caller who'd like to join in, and I'd like to tell all the people who are listening that they certainly can do that if they have a question. And I should introduce again our guest, T.H. Breen. He is William Smith Mason, Professor of American History at Northwestern University. And he is the author of the book that lays this out, this argument out in some detail. It's titled The Marketplace of Revolution, and it's published by the Oxford University Press. We certainly would welcome people who want to call in, 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455. And our first caller is in Champaign, and it's line one.
Hello. I'd like to ask a question, maybe a little broader, about the arguments regarding the origins of American democracy. I was just reading in the newspaper, I think yesterday, about a conservative Christian group that believed that they take the Bible literally, and they have a college for the homeschooled, and they're apparently teaching that the origins of American democracy come from the Bible. And I would agree that, you know, religious ideologies and movements had an effect on the development of democracy, but it seems that they might skip over about 2,300 years of so-called Western history. And I was wondering if you could, you know, for example, there might be some anti-organized religious some movements that are anti-organized religion that had something to do with the development of democracy in Europe. But I was wondering if you could recommend any books on the history of the history of democratic ideals and practices, which led to the American Revolution and its subsequent development of democracy.
Well, that's it's a very, very complicated question, and I'm probably going to let you down about a reading list. I'm sure as soon as the program's over, I'll think of 10 titles. But let me just say that what we're finding in the world today, that you cannot just transplant democracy as if it was a bulb in spring. Democratic societies create a genuine trust among participants that leads to a free exchange of ideas and open participation in the political forum. Takes one very long time to develop. The revolutionaries had a long tradition of town meetings and open debate and a full sense of a vibrant press in which ideas and differences were aired openly. These are all important elements in American democracy, and it's very difficult to say that one is more important than the other. But these strands came together so that on the eve of the American Revolution, through these newspapers and subscription lists passing petitions house to house, one gets a feeling of quite ordinary people finding a political empowerment at a key moment in their political lives. It's not quite democracy in the sense that women or blacks or Indians or the very poor were allowed to vote, but you can find certain processes that suggest a movement towards a rights-based exchange of ideas, a mutual political respect. And to say it's simply from the Bible really, I think, flies in the face of a lot of recorded history.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Other questions, welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I want to return to a point you just touched on before we took the caller, and this is something that shows just how it is that the consumer boycott on the side of the colonies, why it was effective, and that is just how important the American market was to British manufacturers. And I think, if I remember right, isn't it the case that at one point half of Britain's exports were going to the colonies?
Absolutely. And if you remove one item, very, very heavy woolens from that list, most of those heavy woolens went to what is now East Europe or Russia. But if you remove that, then the Americans even took off a larger percentage of what were called sundries, just simply mixed packages, glassware, metal goods, ceramics, lots and lots of ceramics. David, I found that you could make a Staffordshire, say a pot or pitcher, in the Midlands, glaze it with the finest materials, maybe with a decal, ship it on a canal down to a port like Bristol, put it on a vessel, ship it across the ocean, unload it in Philadelphia, take it on a wagon up, say, to Lancaster, Pennsylvania, and undersell the local potters. Mm-hmm. It really, really a phenomenal business sense. And of course, Josiah Wedgwood may have been the greatest businessman of the 18th century. His ability to inflame desire by saying, look, if you buy this certain plate, I want you to know that the royals use this plate, or Pitt uses this plate. And then these advertisements would appear in America, and they felt like they were part of this larger empire through their use of goods. Almost every form of advertising, and as I said earlier, credit mechanism that we think of today was used. In fact, even in one Philadelphia store, I discovered that they, shades of Starbucks, offered customers free coffee if they would come in and look at the goods.
How among the leading sort of thinkers on this side of the Atlantic, how did they think about this great enthusiasm for consumer goods that Americans can displayed?
Well, there was always, I argue in the book, that consumer activity often makes people uneasy. They because they feel that maybe the consumer is given over to luxury and frivolous behavior, and What wealthy folks often do is to say, well, look, it's fine for me to have these silks and whatnot, but if the middle class or lower classes buy them, well, my goodness, they're going to go broke, or they'll use all their money, they'll be starving. So the luxury debate was often used as a way of class control. As I document clearly, that the middle and lower classes would have none of it. They wanted to look pretty and warm and sexy, just like their betters, and the market afforded them. And this then developed into a very interesting phenomena, and that is, as people could dress as they wanted to, then the old kind of status lines from the past became dissolved or untrustworthy. In other words, if you saw a dandy walking in your town with a nice satin red coat and maybe a sword, is he a member of the elite? Is he a governor? Or is he maybe a guy that just won the lottery as a middle-class guy, lower-class guy who just knew how to buy good clothes? And so you'll find a lot of references in this literature to confidence men, people that you don't know. Are they just good consumers, or are they proper, the upper class? This whole consumer market, in other words, had a capacity to upset values, and of course it fed into the American revolutionary situation.
You talked about the fact that there certainly on the British side was an appreciation of just how important the American market was, and that encouraged this idea of colonies as markets for goods produced in the home country. But I wonder just to what extent, though, people really appreciated how important that was and what it would mean if somehow that market was closed off to them.
The British may have inadvertently suggested to the Americans just how important it was by writing incessantly during the 1750s and 60s about the American market, often in purely economic terms, but they did suggest that the dominance of the American sector was becoming a key defining element of the English manufacturing. And, of course, the implicit suggestion was that if something upset that market, then English workers would be thrown out, there'd be bankruptcies and what have you. I really want to emphasize, David, that the boycott as a political tool, or the disruption of a consumer market for political purposes, may have been the colonists' greatest political invention. If you read textbooks, the first thing people say is, well, look, the colonists stumbled across the balanced government. You look at the Constitution. They were so brilliant with Madison and all that. I take that on board. But I do believe this new political strategy of using consumption as a weapon against the empire is a very underappreciated political invention. And in a modern economy like our own, I think they perhaps have something to teach us.
Well, certainly boycott is a 19th century term. In fact, it was named after a guy named Boycott. So you may not want to apply that term, but in fact, that's what it was. And it seems that I think you make the argument that as a revolutionary kind of a tool, that in fact, before this, no one had ever done it before.
Not in a massive way. And you're quite right. The word is a little anachronistic. The boycott comes from 19th century Irish history. The colonists would have said non-importation. But it's the same thing. And no one had ever tried it on this massive scale before. And in each successive crisis, the enforcement became more efficient, so that on the actual eve of independence, the committees of safeties in the little towns monitored their neighbors' consumption. What you bought became a outward sign of your political commitment. And I know of no other revolution that, as I say in the book, it was profoundly a bourgeois revolution, but no less radical for that. When you have committees constituted up and down the Atlantic coast called the associations, poking into their neighbors' consuming patterns, you had a massive enforcement mechanism. And those committees led into the new government of the post-empire. The independent government came out of those committees.
We have some other callers to talk with, and let us do that, starting with Robinson, and that's on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Yes, good morning. I'm sorry to change the course of the discussion, but recently you spoke about Staffordshire ware being perhaps shipped from Bristol, and I recently became involved in researching a shard of broken Staffordshire recovered from under the oldest house in Palestine, and I researched an inventory of a store in Palestine in 1830, which admittedly is long after your area of expertise, but the store listed innumerable pieces of what they call Liverpool ware, and I wondered if Stoke-on-Trent, being so much closer to Liverpool, would not have been the port from which Staffordshire was shipped. Have you any knowledge of this?
Well, not the exact kind. I might say that as the American market heated up, the whole transportation system in England shifted, and Liverpool is one of the western ports that was developed, I wouldn't say created, but certainly developed, to be an outport for the American market. Bristol is somewhat older, but these western ports experienced a degree of prosperity as ships left for the colonies, and many of them carrying Staffordshire ware. So it's possible that any of those ports, including London, would have been the source of your piece. I might say that throughout colonial America, in old wells or trash pits, from Georgia all the way up to western Massachusetts, you find shards, little pieces of this Staffordshire ware, some of it very fine. And one of the most interesting discoveries was that in some of the slave quarters in Virginia and in the Carolinas, they also were finding pieces of this imported ware. I suspect it was handed down from the master, but it literally appeared everywhere throughout early America. And the piece that you found, it doesn't surprise me, because in the early 19th century, as the English became even more industrialized, their ability to turn out this stuff was greatly enhanced. And Americans, after they became free, went back to the English marketplace.
Yes, and I might add that the British capitalized on it by putting scenes of America and Washington and Lafayette on their stoneware. Thank you.
Right, thank you.
Let's go to Champagne next. This is line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I was coming into work today at the University of Illinois, where I teach a course that is currently we're doing our once over lightly on South and Southeast Asian history. And the era, I was wondering if you'd had any thoughts about what was going on, the interactions between what was going on with the British colonies in America and the rapidly developing British colonies in South Asia and India in particular, whether or not there was the fact that that they were taking over India at a rapid pace meant that perhaps there was less pressure to move, you know, to squelch this rebellion in the United States.
That's a really an inspired question. All I can say is that some good work needs to be done. I suspect from my research that the closest analogy to the American Revolution is the movement for national independence in India. It's not quite what you asked, but I think the whole movement, what the Indian historians called the Swadeshi, making homemade goods and trying to break Indian consumers away from the British cloth makers, has many parallels in the United States, or the formation of the United States. And the reason is that they were both economic colonies of the mother countries. And in order to establish independence and create a spirit of genuine nationalism, they had to sever that economic consumer link, at least temporarily. On a broader scale, of course, the colonists and the English bought China, real China, which they exchanged for silver. And so by the middle of the 18th century, on really quite modest household tables, you're getting Asian China shipped to England and then to the American colonies in an extraordinarily complicated trade. Historians now talk about Atlantic history, but that's really sort of a misnomer. By the middle of the 18th century, you're talking about global imperial commerce, and you really are right to bring our attention to the Asian side.
All right. Champaign County is next, line number two. Hello.
Hi. Well, it seems to me that looking backward, from now, and emphasizing consumer, is you have to be careful not to distort things, it seems to me. I think it's, you know, of course the boycotts were important, of course, but it wasn't just the people that were consuming. It was also local producers here that wanted to have a better exchange rate. It's also the fact that, you know, and maybe we're not thinking about this because we're not thinking empire and colony, and there were also the prices for the raw materials that were being taken from here that were important to the equation as well, as far as that goes. So it just seems to me that by just using the word, I mean, obviously it was in the economic revolution to some extent, and it was actually unfinished as Shea's Rebellion, which happened some years later, need for land reform, which was never really filled in any great way, was part of the equation too.
No, I don't want to create. Thank you. You're right. I don't want to create a sense of consumer reductionism that it's an all-purpose answer. But look, at the time of the eve of the American Revolution, the local producers, the local artisans, were unable to meet the demand in the colonies for cloth, especially the lightweight cottons or the prints that were popular. They were unable to meet the demand for glassware, for metalware. All of this had to be imported. When we talk about a consumer boycott, it represents a real sacrifice in the lives of a lot of people. They had to want to make a statement against the empire. Now, in terms of furniture and wood products, sure, the colonists had a lot of expert furniture makers, and they could go along. But the consumer side was the side that allowed the colonists to mount these united movements that brought colonies together. If they had relied on production, they wouldn't have gotten very far, because each colony had a different product, a different crop, and the Northerners were already quite hostile to slave labor. And so what I'm saying is if South Carolina and Massachusetts had to come to the table and talk about production, it would have broken down very quickly, because they would have started fighting about slavery. But if they talked about consumption and non-importation, they were able to make these conversations that led to trust. That's the point of the book. It isn't that the consumer marketplace caused the revolution. It's that the consumer marketplace allowed people to create a conversation in which they could imagine their own political freedom.
It still seems to me that the idea of being a captive market for the products of the center, as it were, you know, that is what their commonality was, but to focus on that to the without looking at the larger picture. I mean, maybe it is that you're doing a service by pointing out something that hasn't been focused on, but it seems that that's pretty clearly.
Well, this is a new product, but let me say that Sam Adams was probably the most radical revolutionary that came along. In a letter to one of the Lees, I don't have it in front of me, but this is a rough quotation, that until the Americans free themselves from the baubles of Britain, they will never realize political independence. I mean, he saw the key link, in part economic, part political, part psychological, that a colony of an empire, to be truly free, had to cut this dependence they had. And as I said to an earlier caller, a very, very similar process can be traced in the Indian subcontinent in the late 19th and early 20th century.
But it still seems that he's also, I think he would be, since the class he was, would be talking about the possibility for local production and more indigenous economy, which obviously takes capital, and you have to have the resources at this competitive price, which the England could have at a competitive at a lower price because of its geopolitical situation. So, thank you.
I would say, David, to the caller, that the whole basis of the Hamiltonian system in the 1790s was to try to create a federal government that would sustain and encourage American manufacturing so that it could, I mean, in other words, once we started making these goods, we could exert our power in the global marketplace. That was unthinkable in 1776. We are just simply the infrastructure of manufacturing was just in a too infant state. So the, as I say, consumer boycotts represented a political sacrifice, but people were willing to make in order to achieve their political goal.
Our guest is T.H. Breen. He's professor of American history at Northwestern University, an authority on the culture and politics of the early Atlantic world. He's written six major books and has a new one out that lays out this idea, set of ideas here we've been discussing this morning. So if you'd like to look at it, the book is titled The Marketplace of Revolution, the subtitle How Consumer Politics Shaped American Independence. It's published by the Oxford University Press. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. On again to Urbana and line one. Hello.
Oh, good morning. Mm-hmm. Sounds like a good book, and what an intriguing idea. History is my favorite fiction. I love it, and I get a lot of my leads from David's programs. What you reminded me of this morning was a book that David's program put us on to years ago, Albion's Seed. And to pick up on a point you made, that the four cultures that Albion's Seed identified emigrating from Great Britain were natural antagonists in many ways, and it really would take something unitary to pull them together. And subsequent to the successful revolution, you look ahead about 60 years, and cultural antagonisms have torn the nation apart. What I wondered, though, another clue. I think you made some hint of it or alluded to it. Were sumptuary laws a helpful precursor to this these bans on use of imported British goods?
The only examples that I've ever found were in the century previous, the 17th century. There were a number of attempts in Virginia and in Massachusetts to make people dress according to their class, so that if an ordinary guy got a smart coat or his wife wore too much jewelry, they could be fined in Virginia or in Massachusetts. By the 18th century, the marketplace was just too robust. Too many. The velocity of the flow of goods was too great, and the access to credit to ever possibly enforce sumptuary laws. That really was gone by the early 18th century. As I was saying earlier, this is what led to the possibility of very ordinary people suddenly appearing in finery and creating great confusion about social status.
And a fair amount of literature. That the character, the upstart, and the person masquerading as someone better than he is becomes
right.
A standard figure.
Absolutely, well, and it goes all the way up into the 19th century. Melville's Confidence Man is an example of this kind of literature.
Let's talk with someone in Chicago next, line four. Hello.
Yes, your opening remarks when you talked about the ideas of words like democracy and freedom just don't resonate with people who have diverse ideas. It really reminded me of what's happening in Iraq right now and the difficulty in developing, quote-unquote, a democracy with this multi-ethnic and multi-religious group. At the same time, it seems like what you were talking about, the material things, what they see as the lack of material things, the lack of sufficient water, food, and security, is developing a nationalism between the Sunnis and the Shiites, at least, and a nationalism faced against the source that they see as depriving them, the Americans. So I really was very struck by that, how much material issues, material comforts, become an issue for nationalism.
I think that's a very good observation. I can't speak to Iraqi politics, but your point is well taken, and that is rhetoric alone, and you know, our foreign policy. We say we're bringing liberty or democracy to another country. If you don't think out the structures in which these words will have meaning, they just never take seed. And for us to think that we will transplant our political system around the world without understanding the cultural embeddedness is really a form of high arrogance, I suspect.
And I guess I have a second question. This is about democracy versus nationalism. It seems that perhaps ideas of nationalism are easier to develop than ideas of democracy.
Absolutely. I mean, any government, even governments that practice behavior that you and I would find abhorrent, can experience nationalism. After all, Hitler's Germany was highly inspired by nationalism. Stalin's Russia, Soviet Russia, was a nationalizing state. Only sometimes does nationalism visit democracies, but there's no obvious link between democracy and nationalism. Nationalism can do some really ugly things if it takes root in an authoritarian system.
Okay, and this is my last question. Do you think in our culture we confuse democracy and nationalism?
Sometimes. I suspect that without thinking out the full impact of democracy, we talk about America nationalism in terms of very loose symbols. But what you're doing is urging us, to think a little bit more deeply about the content of democracy, and I applaud that.
Thank you.
All right, thanks. We have talked about, you laid out the idea, establishing just how important the American market was for British manufacturers, and that people here in the United States, and it was not the United States, in the colonies, had a great enthusiasm for goods that could be high-quality goods that could also be produced cheaply in Britain, ceramics and cloth and clothing, metalware, glassware, things like that. So you have documented, I think, pretty thoroughly just what the level of consumption was here in the United States. And then also made this argument that it was their common experience as consumers and the willingness to give that up that gave... still there? Professor Breen? Professor Breen, you still there?
Yes, hello.
Yeah, still there?
Yeah, sure.
I'm sorry. I thought maybe for a moment we'd lost you.
You did.
okay. But you're back.
I'm right. Here. I don't know what happened.
Anyway, I was just, again, sort of laying out the argument as we made it. And the question I'm going for is, you know, when you see just how much interest there was here in the colonies in these exported goods from Britain, how much people wanted them, then that also gets you at the idea of appreciating just how much people were giving up by saying, no, we're not going to drink the tea, we're not going to wear the clothes, we're not going to have the teapots, we're not going to have any of that. But that it must have been a difficult thing, a difficult sell to persuade people to do that, because obviously you were trying to get them to give up stuff that they wanted, that they had enthusiastically been buying. I mean, there's another big part here that we really haven't gotten to, and that is how it is that this organized boycott of the British goods, how it is that it actually happened.
Right. It was very difficult to organize, and you raise an important point that I think maybe we've forgotten, is if freedom and values requires sometimes sacrifice. And the sacrifice in the revolutionary period was disproportionately fell on women. And when you don't have cloth, you don't have some of the sundries coming into the household, it fell to women to weave and to make goods and to reallocate their time. And so if people in American men and women and families really felt that the grievances of being part of this empire were so severe that they were willing to transform their household economies, then indeed this was a powerful political movement. I might say, David, that none of your callers today have raised a question that often comes up in discussions in the book, when that is, we have a lot of grievances throughout the United States today, and our dependence, for instance, on oil, and what it's how it's hurting our economy and mm-hmm. potentially our prosperity. Boycotts and the kinds of issues that the revolutionaries brought up could be practiced today. But I suspect what's lacking is our willingness to sacrifice, as the colonists did, for a common political cause.
All right. We have someone here in Urbana to talk with next. Let's do that. Line number one. Hello.
Line one?
Yes.
Yes, I think I missed the connection you made between that very first teapot and your theory. Could you go over that again?
When I, as I say, met this teapot in the Wallace Gallery, that clearly had been manufactured in England and shipped you know, all the way across the ocean to help the Americans protest British policy, in this case the Stamp Act, I realized how tightly bound up the consumers were with policy.
How did you know that it had been shipped for that purpose?
Well, because it says, I mean, you can read the little emblem on the mark. It says, "No Stamp Act" is the decoration on this little teapot. It was clearly a political thing. It was helping the colonists protest British policy.
So the manufacturer in England actually helped them.
Right. I mean, these English businessmen and women were about as savvy as I've ever seen. And then when the act was repealed, as David and I were talking, there were more teapots that came over to America helping them celebrate their victory, saying Stamp Act repealed. And the time of responding to the market and the politics was almost instantaneous, just a few months to ship it across the ocean.
Then weren't the manufacturers cutting off their nose, harming themselves?
Well,
if they were encouraging the boycott.
Businessmen tend to look for the short term, I suspect, more than the long term, and this was a quick market. I might say in 1765, during the Stamp Act protest, no one on either side of the ocean had yet imagined independence. It took a couple of more crises to develop this boycott into the ultimate political weapon that it became in 1774, 75, 76. This was pretty early innings. So, but sure, the British manufacturers were unwittingly convincing the Americans that they had power in their pocketbook.
I see. Thank you.
All right, thanks. I think it's good to underscore the point that you just make, that in fact this the boycott that we've talked about, this took some time. This didn't happen overnight.
Right. I mean, in the early days, especially in the period 1768 to 1770, they were deeply suspicious that different areas, different ports were going to cheat. The New Yorkers were always suspect that they'd say that they were going to do a boycott and then they'd secretly bring in goods. And the New Yorkers accused the Bostonians of this. It took a while to create this basis of trust. And if it hadn't been for newspapers, I suspect it would never have occurred. But the newspapers became absolutely a key element in helping what I say distant strangers to feel part of a larger movement that now could be enforced clearly through clear non-importation rituals. But you're absolutely right, David. It was slow, painful. There were a lot of betrayals along the road until they finally got it right.
Mm. And how exactly did this, was it enforced? I mean, was it in fact people kind of looking over their neighbor's shoulders just to make sure that everybody was with the program?
Well, as it moved along, the enforcement took on ever greater bite. In the period 1768 to 1770, the mechanism was largely shame. a merchant would import goods against the committee's will, and his name would be in the press. People would be told to avoid a certain shop that didn't go along with the Patriot rule. But by the eve of the American Revolution, these committees were actually visiting individuals who were suspected of breaking the boycott. And while they're may have not punished them physically, the communal force, the power of mutual shaming, was very great indeed. As I might say in the Tea Act, the Tea Protest, everyone, all your listeners knows about the Tea Party,
right.
Chucking. But in fact, most of the little towns demanded the citizens bring all their little canisters of tea to the common green, where they were burnt on mock funeral pyres, purging the colonists of what they said was the political poison so they could be free.
We're going to have to stop. We've used our time. For people who are interested in reading more, I suggest you look at the book. It's The Marketplace of Revolution by our guest T.H. Breen, published by the Oxford University Press. T.H. Breen is a professor of American history at Northwestern University. And Professor Breen, we thank you very much.
Thank you, David. Enjoy talking to you.
I also want to say thanks there to the folks at Northwestern for providing the ISDN connection so we could have a good, clear conversation with the guest.